If it ain't got that swing, do I, 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 do I?
No, it don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is swing.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a special microcast episode of the Diesel Powered Podcast. We're coming to you today concerning... Oh, let's start over. Cut. Okay. Or as a...
I don't know how John does it.
That's good enough. Let's do it again. Okay. Here we go. Pause. Whew. Here we go. On my mark. 3, 2, 1. Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special microcast episode of the Diesel Powered Podcast. Tonight, Eric and I will be talking exclusively about Season 1 of Man in the High Castle, the Amazon's television series that it wrapped up several months ago. But the cool thing is Season 2 is only a week away. So we thought we'd do a recap of Season 1 and then in preparation for the upcoming season. So say hi to everybody, Eric.
Hello, everybody. This is Eric coming from you from our underground bunker where the grasshopper lies heavy.
That's right. Oh, this is going to be fun. I so love this series.
What's there not to like, Larry? I mean, in all honesty, what the thing is that it's a very scary, dystopic version of the future, but it's so beautifully well filmed, you can just look beyond that just for a short bit.
I agree. So, as you can imagine, folks, we need to put out a disclaimer, Eric and I. We're going to be giving lots and lots and lots of spoilers. So if you haven't seen the series, if you don't mind having it spoiled for you, stay with us. If you don't want to hear what happens, bye-bye. Other than that, we'd love you to stay with us and listen to it. And when we're done, we would love your feedback. Tell us what you love, or well, if there's something you don't like, tell us that too, about the show. Tell us what you agree with us on. Tell us what you disagree with us on. Okay? All right, Eric. Hey, before we dive into the main subject, I think you and I want to bring up an important piece of a date in history.
Well, you know what? I think that it's... I don't know. Is it coincidence? Is it irony? Is it synchronicity? This is a very... We're recording this on the eve of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and every history buff should know, every high school student and every citizen of the free world should know that this is when the United States entered World War II. Much to our shame and chagrin, we really dragged our heels into getting into World War II officially. We got into World War II unofficially by helping Britain out with the Lend-Lease Act through Churchill and Roosevelt, with a lot of secret backdoor agreements and shipping things across the ocean. But it wasn't until the bombing of Pearl Harbor that when we decided, well, we didn't decide, we were sort of thrust into World War II. And it is the major date for not only history buffs but diesel punks, because this is when things really get going. It's a cornerstone for all of us, and I believe that as far as Americans are concerned, this is, I think, the last real good fight that we ever fought, the last real legitimate battle between good and evil. Whereas it's like the lines were drawn, it's the last really good fight that we actually fought that wasn't convoluted earlier. It took until the end of World War II when things get, I think, really conspiratorial. But what do you think, Larry?
Oh, that's a very good point. In fact, you're echoing some terms that come out sometimes. Some historians called World War II the last good war. So you're echoing exactly what they say. It was the last time everybody was like, "Okay, we're all in it together." Stick your courage to the, nail your courage to the sticking post. Here we go, guys. Korea wasn't popular, and it didn't last long, but it wasn't popular. Vietnam, we know, was horribly unpopular. So yeah, good point. And I saw not too long ago, I think it was a CBS Sunday Morning, said that except for the American Revolution, World War II most closely defined modern America. There's two great events in modern, and so even more so than the Civil War, World War II defined modern America. And so yeah, it's, I don't know, like you said, I don't know if it's irony, synchronicity, whatever it is, that we're recording an ep this all this discussion we're going to be having about a story in which we lost World War II.
And it's also worthy of mentioning that for my website, the Fedora Chronicles, I have been doing a lot of reading about alternate history or alternate views of history. And I think another, there are two, three really great books I think that all diesel punks really need to read. It is Jim Marrs's The Rise of the Fourth Reich, which talks about how Nazis have infiltrated or they've been invited into American politics and American science and the consequences thereof. And Jim Marrs also goes through aspects of World War II history that a lot of people really don't know, as far as how close the Nazis were to getting an atomic bomb, how the Japanese were investigating their own version of the atomic bomb. And how we brought over a lot of Nazi scientists into American science. But the most well-known recipient of the programs associated with Operation Paperclip is Wernher von Braun, the man who a rocket scientist and is largely responsible for the Mercury and Gemini and Apollo program, and to a very large extent the American Space Shuttle. And he is pretty much the godfather or the Dutch uncle of the American space program. And so that's one book I think that a lot of people need to read. And there's another competing book. I don't have the author's name. When Johnny edits this, he could edit this in later. The author is an alternate book of what it would have looked like if the Nazis won. It's a book called Fatherland, which is another alternate view of what would have happened if the Germans won.
Oh yeah, and that was made into a made-for-television motion picture.
You know, that's awesome to hear, but I have not seen or heard it's that mini series. It's but the book itself, it's on my wish list to read. And then there's so many various other books out there. There's also do a quick search of Operation Paperclip.
Oh, okay. Well, Fatherland was written by Robert Harris. I
Okay.
mentioned him in the as a I mentioned that as a diesel punk novel in the Diesel Punk Encyclopedia. That's the only reason I know that. And you said Operation Paperclip?
Yep. I'm
Okay.
actually looking up the author. We'll edit this out
Operation.
later here. Operation Paperclip.
We'll fix it in editing.
It is the name of the book here. Oh, hey now.
Operation Paperclip. Well,
The
that
full
doesn't come up as a book. It comes up as a actual
There is
of
a
a
there
group of 104 rocket scientists. Wow.
I'm looking up right here. Let's see here.
It's Wernher von Braun.
Okay.
Yeah, had the Soviets gotten hold of these guys, lock, stock, and barrel, because they got plenty, but had they gotten hold of these guys, Or had they been stuck behind the Berlin Wall?
The Iron Curtain.
Yeah, it might have completely changed history because we would have been so far behind in the space race. We were far enough behind as it is.
Yeah, the thing is like if the Soviets had been able to capture all the Nazi scientists and they were able to get ahead of us in all of these major areas, whether it's science, rocketry, medicine, whatever, I we would definitely be talking a different language right now. I mean, literally, I think that maybe that without a doubt, the Soviets, I think, would have gotten the upper hand.
Yeah. Well, scary stuff. A little atomic punk alternate history there.
Oh, the name of the book that I would really appreciate people at least checking out. It is called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America, and it was published a little more than a year ago. And the name of the author is Annie Jacobson, and Annie Jacobson does a great job. Not only did she write the book, but her silken voice is responsible for the audible version as well. And it's a captivating book to listen to. It is, and it's a real eye opener looking into the American politic, which is, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No. Keep on going.
And the thing is that if you couple Jim Mars's book, Rise of the Fourth Reich, and Annie Jacobson's book, Operation Paperclip, you cannot help but wonder, and especially in the light of the show that we're doing tonight, we defeated the Germans, but did we really defeat the Nazis? Or are they here taking over the American politic? And that gets into some very, very controversial topics right now.
Sure.
So kind of like
Yeah.
in a third rail, I don't know if I'm prepared to touch right now here with this
Right.
charged
Well,
political climate.
maybe we avoid. I could go there, but cross my mind. Just keep your opinions to yourself, Larry. Oh, by the way, I did find the book you're talking about by Annie Jacobson
Yes.
at, wait for it, the CIA's official website.
Exactly.
Sent. The CIA has a library where they have online book reviews.
Yep.
And this is reviewed by somebody named Jay Watkins. And he talks quite a lot of details. And it looks like he really praises the book. Jacobson provides insights on joint intelligence coordination and cooperation among U.S. services. Although she understandably questions the morality of the decision to hire Nazi SS scientists, Jacobson balances her judgments with an understanding of the perceived threat of the Soviet Union under Stalin. So it's a very positive review, although the CIA, says disclaimer, this is, just this guy's opinion.
This woman's opinion, yeah.
It is posted at the CIA's official website,
Yeah.
CIA.gov.
Absolutely.
Wow, very cool. Okay,
I
you
think
know, go
what we
ahead.
want I think we what we wanted to do is so that's the background that I want people to sort of have in their minds in talking about Man in the High Castle and know that in all honesty, if you look at it, we almost nearly lost the war. And who's to say that they didn't eventually win with that in with that all that in mind? So anyway, on to the show about the show.
On to the show. Thank you to all the men that fought and gave their lives and during those dark days. Thankfully, this is fiction we're talking about here. So on to the show, like Eric said. Man in the High Castle. What can I say? It's not just a love affair that Eric and I have with it. Critics love this show. 95% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Wow.
I just want to quickly interject here. How could anybody not like Man in the High Castle?
Well, you and I say that, but, you know, TV critics, you know, jaundiced view, so forth.
I just want to know who was the 5% of the critics that reviewed it who didn't like it.
And it's 95% of 57 critics. 57. The consensus on the site says, by executive producer Ridley Scott, The Man in the High Castle is unlike anything else on TV, with an immediately engrossing plot driven by quickly developed characters in a fully realized post-World War II dystopia. That's all, folks. Oh, no. I mean, that is just... Wow. I think that says it very well, don't you?
It was very succinct. I'll tell you, that it really, really sort of got to the point really quick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you could just put that, you know, right there. People, if I hadn't seen the show, that would have turned me on to it.
No, I think that there's so many aspects to the show that I think that is important to talk about. And talking about just the opening of the show, whereas... Mm-hmm. There's something about alternate history. It's one of the reasons why the Back to the Future movies are so popular, or any time travel movies are popular, because you get to dabble with, like, the what if. Any alternate reality is able to go in a direction where not a lot of other science fiction is able to go. What would have happened if, like, the entire steampunk, dieselpunk movie, What if steam and diesel were able to produce the same amount of power as, say, you know, atomic engines or whatever like that? It's the entire what if. And it's, if you look at it, when the book was originally, that the original book that this was based on, Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick, who is famous for works such as Blade Runner, which talks about an alternate future. The thing is that when this book was first released, I mean, it was controversial. Mm-hmm. It was definitely one of those movies, whereas it's like, I mean, I really don't know if you really want to be able to, you know, entertain these ideas. And what a lot of people don't realize is that this book was written and released during the early years of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. And it won the Hugo Award for Best Novel back in 1963. Mm-hmm. And all of that, you know, implies in the year 1963. So it was released so soon after the end of World War II, and it really sort of it was a very indeed controversial book at the time. Mm-hmm. So
I agree.
It's like, if you love science fiction, you love alternate realities, it's a great novel. But it really shook a lot of people up.
Oh, sure. Exactly. Well, you know, you mentioned just now about the opening. I'd like to talk a little bit about the opening. You almost know this show's going to be something else when you sit down and then the opening comes on. We've talked a little bit long time ago, Johnny and I, and we talked about the opening. You can find the opening online, by the way. So if you've never seen it, you can find the opening online. What it starts out with an old-fashioned movie spinning up, okay, with the fluttering on, you know, like we all used to have back when I was a boy, at least I did. You know, the movie and the reel, and you'd watch the movie at home, maybe home movies. And then you see, like, the Statue of Liberty. You see Mount Rushmore. And projected on all of this is this what almost seems to be like newsreel footage.
Oh, you mean the opening credits. And yeah.
The opening segment, the opening intro to the show. And you start seeing the map where how the U.S. is divided, with the Germany forces moving in from the east up to the Rockies, and then the Japanese coming in from the west, again dividing, slicing up the country with the Rockies in between as a no man's land buffer zone between the two big empires. But then there's that song, Edelweiss, which we all probably remember from Sound of Music.
Exactly. Christopher Plummer knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, indeed. But what people, a lot of people, they have misunderstandings about the song. You know, Eric, a lot of people think that it really is a classic Austrian folk song. But it's not. It was written for the Sound of Music by the great duo Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. See, this is one of the things I love about talking to you, Larry. You always, it's always an education. So tell us about the origins of Edelweiss and what is it supposed to mean? What's the significance of the song?
Edelweiss is actually a very subversive song because, of course, remember the storyline. It's almost like, kind of like Man in the High Castle. Austria had just been taken over by Germany, okay? And Edelweiss was actually the flower of Austria, not Germany. So when he sings about Edelweiss, and then the last lyric, bless my homeland forever, he is actually singing a subversive song about national identity of Austria.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to write this sweet song, but have this subversive aspect to it. Now, the way they work this, not only is it hauntingly beautiful, the musician, what is her name? Jeanette Olsen. I wrote it down. Jeanette Olsen. One of the intriguing aspects of it is not only this minimalist piece, there's very little, if any, musical accompaniment to it. But they leave out a verse. The beginning section goes, Edelweiss, Edelweiss, every morning you greet me, small and white, clean and bright, you look happy to meet me. They leave out every morning you greet me in the TV opening song. And it gives this disjointed feel to it. It kind of, even if you don't know the lyrics, it kind of, I found it a little disjointed, and that's intentional.
Yeah.
If you think about it. Because history's been, it's disjointed.
Exactly.
It's broken. This is not how history's supposed to be.
Yes.
And so it's a subversive song, but it has this hint of German with the Edelweiss people.
Yeah.
You know, that was Hitler's favorite flower, supposedly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. There was even a song, Edelweiss, Hitler's favorite flower. The Fuhrer's favorite flower. Well, he was Austrian.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Yeah. It was propaganda. But so it's this mix, and it's the same. I think Rodgers and Hammerstein would love how to use it, and they would have no problem with taking that one lyric, that one sentence out, and using it in the way that they use it in the show.
It's very purposeful. It's a very purposeful exclusion, I believe. And the way it's sung in the show is it's very haunting, and it is very sort of, I think melancholy is the best word for it.
That's good. Yeah, I agree. And then it ends with this
And grabs you and by you the see throat.
This Nazi flag, the Nazi flag in the Japanese Imperial rising sun.
Flags flag. Sewn together. And it was just like, you just know. I think that the best use of a propaganda film in a theater is you see in the beginning, one of our main characters sitting in the theater, and he's watching this piece of propaganda film, and it's the perfect example of exposition dialogue, whereas it gives you, hey, it's a new morning in America. Everything's great. Everybody has a job. Everybody is making money, and everybody knows their place. Sieg Heil, America.
I love it. And then you see the modified American flag with the swastika. Sieg Heil.
And you know, oh crap. Because they're really going there. And it was just like, it is. Now, are you familiar with any of the work of Philip K. Dick?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I love Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the original source novel for Blade Runner.
Exactly. And there's a lot to, when you're watching this and you're a fan of the novel, this is not like the Game of Thrones where it's like a 1-to-1 ratio. It's not an exact representation. It's basically taking off on the original idea from Man in the High Castle. Because the two of them sort of like coexist in two alternate realities of their own. And
Good point. And
right off the bat, not to spoil anything any more than we already have, but the thing is that it captures Philip K. Dick's paranoia. Whereas one of our main characters, as he leaves the movie theater early, he's being followed by somebody, and we don't know who that somebody is. But it was just like, and it is exactly just like so many other aspects of Philip K. Dick's sort of, it really sort of taps into the sort of like the dark atmospheric paranoia and dystopia. It is by far the best dystopia. And so we follow the main character, Joe Blake, you know, to a meeting with subversives, people who are looking to overthrow the Nazi regime. And it's perfect exposition dialogue talking about, you don't know what you're talking about. I was there, I served on Virginia Beach when the Krauts first showed up. And you get and the thing is that within 15 minutes of the snappy dialogue that goes back and forth, we learn a whole bunch of things. We learn that the Japs took the West, like the map suggested in the beginning. We know that there was an atomic bomb that was dropped on Washington, D.C. And we know that there was a long, hard-fought battle between the citizens who were here in the United States fighting off the invading forces of Germany. And there's still this underground movement going along. And it was just like, and Joe Blake is told, is his mission is to drive this truck across the country. And, you know, when we see, and along his journey, we get to explore more of this new America, as it were. Go ahead.
Sure.
Go ahead, Larry.
No, you're doing great, and I'm glad you went to the point about him driving across the country. Because to me, one of the creepiest moments in this opening show, occurs as he's driving across the country.
Yeah.
When he gets a blowout in the truck, and he pulls over, and then the state police officer comes up. Now you're thinking,
sheriff,
it's on. You know, this is going to be something. You know, they're going to get a throwdown. Here comes he comes, this nice guy. Oh, but you know, this is, you know, let me help you with the tire. And hey, you want some of, you know, my wife fixed, you know, two sandwiches for me. You won't split it here. And oh, by the way, can I see your papers? You know, see, you know, and then at one point he says, I don't even know what we were fighting for.
Exactly.
It was like What, you know?
What was the point of
all
this? Oh,
and by the way, what's this white stuff coming down out of the sky? Oh, it's a,
it's a cream.
Tuesday.
Yeah,
it's Tuesday.
It's Tuesday, and it's like they're.
It's Tuesday. What do you mean? Well, the burning, you know, that, oh, it's the, it's a hospital. You know, it's all the cripples and the drain on the state.
Yeah.
And that's when you even is like, oh, my God.
Exactly, it's happening here where they're they're incinerating the bodies of all the sick and the mentally disabled and the handicapped and the elderly and people who won't shut up in movie theaters.
Yeah. And he said, is the drain on the state? Yeah, I don't even know what remember what we were fighting for. While the ashes come down.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just accepted. It's just normal. It's this nice guy. He helped him change the tire. He shared his lunch with him.
Yeah.
And he's just talking like about the, the burning the bodies.
Well, meanwhile, let's talk about Juliana. Juliana Crane, who is on the other side of the country in San Francisco. And through Juliana, who is the audience's advocate, she's we see the world through her eyes, and we see how she is trying to live as an American woman in Japanese-occupied California. And she is really into the culture of, you know, the martial arts and learning how to do calligraphy and stuff like that. And her boyfriend, Frank, is sort of like he's an artist who does subversive artwork. When he's not at the factory building replicas of Western guns that Japanese collectors who are living in the Japanese states of America like to collect. And the thing is, you can tell everybody is prostrated themselves. Everybody is submissive to the Japanese overlords and the white people who regard sort of like the Japanese as you know, sort of like a higher life form or stuff like that. And everybody is like, everybody like bows to, you know, the Japanese overlords and other citizens of Japanese descent who live among them. And Juliana is just like, hey, listen, you know, there's, you know, because what does she learn? Aikido? And it's like Aikido
she's learning Aikido.
And it's about learning how to trust and rely on yourself and turn your adversary's power against him. How do I know that this is not going to feature in later episodes and later seasons, Larry?
Well, that's a very good question. Makes you wonder. I mean, the founder of Aikido, while he was a great soldier, he was also a strong advocate for peace, and that's interesting that she's learning Aikido. Because he was the author of the book called The Art of Peace, which was supposed to be a response to The Art of War by Sun Tzu. So that's a very good observation. I hadn't thought about the fact that she was learning Aikido.
Yeah. And the thing is that, and well, everybody speaks English. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's just a convention just for the viewers here at home. You can see the assimilation. You can see how there are some people who are subversive. There are some people who will not easily submit to the Japanese, including Juliana's sister, who gives her a film. And this is when the series, I almost said movie, like I said, Man in the High Castle, I consider to be nothing more than like a 17-hour long movie with scheduled potty breaks in between. Take as long as you
want.
It's
like the special edition of Lord of the Rings.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. And the thing is that and Juliana sees this movie reel on our home projector, and we learn that she knows that she is in an alternate reality because she watches this film that shows how America and the Allies won the war against Japan and Germany. So automatically, we already know that she knows that she's living in an alternate reality. Yeah. And it's sort of, and it's very meta. It's because the thing is that it's almost like, it's sort of like, this is the only, I'm probably going to be the only person to compare this to Deadpool, where Deadpool, like, looks right into the audience and talks to us. Deadpool is the only person who knows that he's in a movie, and he knows that he's in a story. In some way, Juliana knows that this is an alternate reality. Something's not right. Reality is broken. Mm-hmm. And so she goes on a journey heading towards this city where she's supposed to meet with her contact with the film. And the name of the film is The Grasshopper Lies Heavy. Mm-hmm. And these movies come from this man who is only known as the Man in the High Castle, which then the entire whole MacGuffin of this movie is the title character, the Man in the High Castle. Where is he getting these movies from? And we go from there. Right. And we follow Juliana, who and Joe Blake, who are both going to the same destination but coming from two different directions. And what with Juliana's bus ride from San Francisco to this town in Colorado, and Joe Blake from New York City to the same town where they're supposed to meet with a contact, we get to see their versions of America and the neutral zone in the Rockies. And it was just, what a perfect way to introduce the characters to the characters and the audience to this alternate world. And things take a turn for the worse with Joe Blake, because we find out that Joe Blake is also carrying another film, a longer version of the same film that Juliana has. And when he sees it, spoiler alert, again, we've discovered after the end of the first episode that Joe Blake is really an SS officer who is working covertly to find out where these films are coming from. And then go ahead.
Oh, no. I was about to... you finish your thought, because I think this is a perfect segue to another major character.
So when Joe Blake sees the movie and he starts to fall in love with Juliana, he starts to question, what the hell am I doing? What side am I on? Do I really want to be a Nazi? Or where do I go from here? So now take it away, Larry.
Well, and that's a perfect segue to the senior Nazi that we see in the movie, one of the other major characters. Now, this one was made, if I recall correctly, this one was made solely for the show. I don't recall this character being in the novel at all, which is John Smith, played by the fantastic Rufus Sewell, who we would all remember from the... from Dark City. He plays the SS Obergruppenführer, which is basically the head SS officer in the Greater German Reich of America.
Yeah.
I think he is an absolutely... Well, he's a fantastic character. Complex. But a true believer in the Nazi cause.
Here's the thing. I want to interject this.
Yeah.
He's a good man who happens to be a Nazi who does horrible things because that's his job. And you like him and you hate him, and you hate the fact that you like him. Does that make any sense, or am I alone here?
Yeah. Oh, I love where you're going with this. I completely agree.
I think another thing to realize is that there's a certain language to making films and casting films. And when the casting directors cast somebody into a role, they don't just look at just the actor, and they look at Rufus Sewell. They don't just see him. Because he also carries with him, for good or for ill, he carries other baggage with him as well. And he also carries with him some of the gravitas from the other film that we already talked about earlier, Dark City. Mm-hmm. And here's a guy who is also, his character in Dark City, Rufus's character, he knows he's in some kind of an alternate reality. And so, of course, he brings that cachet with him from his earlier work. Check him out on an internet movie database. And I mean, what the casting directors are trying to, is there a wink and the nod that says, yes, we know. We know that this is an alternate reality. And it's like, you know, and you're watching it as a show. You're watching it at face value. You're watching it as a show in and of itself at face value. But you're also seeing it through the lens of you're an audience member who knows that it's an alternate reality. And it was just like, and it plays on those two different levels with the casting choices that they make, the music that they make. And it's like, it's one of the reasons why, this is one of the reasons why I think it is probably, it's one of the best TV shows on television. And it's right up there with Mad Men, X-Files, Breaking Bad, and they all have something in common. We're dealing with really dark elements of human nature.
Well, sure. I agree completely. Well said. In fact, I think one of the producers, did work on X-Men. I'm not X-Men, X-Files. But X-Files. Along with Ridley Scott. Excellent comments about John. And I tell you what, Rufus plays him so good. And John has, it's so odd. If you look at his home life, it's Ozzie and Harriet. It's Leave It to Beaver. He sits down, and the only difference at the kitchen table is that he's wearing a Nazi uniform, and so is the oldest boy wearing Hitler Youth. Otherwise, he could be wearing a suit, getting ready to go to work, and the boy could be wearing a Boy Scout suit. And it's idealistic, sitting in Long Island.
Yeah.
But they celebrate, instead of Veterans Day or
4th of July,
they celebrate VA Day, Victory in America. See, Kyle, they say to each other. And it's, but it's almost kind of adds to the concern I have a little bit. He is so likable.
Yeah.
it almost makes you wonder, you know, if it wasn't for some of this other stuff, it can kind of make Nazism to be pretty appealing, kind of. Okay, so he has somebody tortured to death. Well, you know how many Americans recently it was revealed in a pro approve of torture?
Yeah.
You know, and he's kind of a clean cut, you know, like I said, daddy knows best.
Exactly.
Type of character. And then he goes to work, puts on a Nazi uniform, and, you know, beats up on, you know, Jews and insurgents, and is a true blue Nazi through and through.
Yeah,
he does it so well. There's no snidely whiplash, and maybe that makes him more even a better. I don't know if I want to use the word villain. I almost used the word villain there. I think he's too complex of a character.
And this cuts me in half to say this. Whereas, is he really even a villain? He is just, he's an administrator. He's a tough administrator. He's a tough man. He's a tough taskmaster. But he's fair. He's not like, you fail once and I'm going to send you to, I'm going to send you to your death. Mm-hmm. He's a good boss. He's the kind of boss where it's, you don't want to let him down.
Yeah, but if you're on the wrong side, he'd have no problem pulling your fingernails out and he'd sleep well at night. He'd sleep well at night, I think, because he's a patriot and he's a true believer. And that leads back to what I think is going to be one of the most interesting subjects that's going to come up next season. His son.
Yeah. His son, his son who's in the Nazi Youth. And it was like his son is like a real true believer because he's never known anything different. So, but speaking of that, there's also the thing is that Rupert Evans, I've seen him before, I just don't remember where, and he plays Juliana's boyfriend, Frank. The artisan who makes these subversive looking pendants and jewelry and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he works in the factory building replica guns. The thing is that wrong place, wrong time. He was abducted by the Japanese occupation garrison troops, beaten and interrogated because he doesn't know where his girlfriend went to. And mm-hmm. and what happens, once again, another spoiler alert, when they find out that he is of Jewish descent as a means of getting to him, because he won't break, because he doesn't know crap. He doesn't know where Juliana mm-hmm. disappeared to. They capture his sister and his niece and nephew, and they put him in a waiting room. A sealed waiting room. And this is not because it's funny. I'm not laughing because it's funny. It's because it's uncomfortable and it's ghoulish the way that they put him to sleep permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and that's pretty gruesome of itself. And
well, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because the inspector Keto, when he's let, now he's let Frank go. He goes, oops, sorry. You know, it's too late. We killed him before we knew. He says, I'm not a monster, Mr. Frank. He says, I am not a monster after what he did. He says, I'm just doing my job. Don't blame me. Not my fault. I'm not a monster. They don't see themselves as monsters.
I think that's the
I'm sure
hardest.
John Smith doesn't see himself as a monster. John C. Smith sees himself as a patriot.
Yeah.
How many atrocities have been committed by individuals who saw themselves as patriots?
Yeah. And that's the problem. And that's the commentary. That's part of the commentary, whereas I'm doing awful things, but I'm doing awful things, but I'm doing awful things for a good reason. And it was, well, you know, and how often do we hear that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're not even talking about the Nuremberg defense, which was, I did it because I was told to.
Yeah, I was just following orders, pal.
I'm just following orders. In this case, it's the ends justify the means. I'm a patriot. This is what was needed. And oops, sometimes you got to break a few eggs.
Yeah.
Wow, so much depth.
So much.
This
there's
series.
Just so much. There's just so much things going on that it was just like it's mind blowing, and then there's just so many aspects of the show that it was just like I'm not even sure, you know how much more can we, you know, what else can we say about this without, you know. Because, I mean, I want everybody to see this, and I want to be able to talk about it at the same time. And it was just like, what do you think of the pilot and the episodes that followed? Do you think that the show kept up with the high standards of the pilot? And did you like all the twists and turns, or were some of the twists and turns sort of, I don't know, maybe telegraphed?
Like, do I think anyone telegraphed? Oh, no. There was several times it's like, oh, wow. Surprise. I wasn't surprised that, what's his name? The German young man saw at the beginning.
You mean
Joe Blake.
Yes.
Joe Blake. I drew a blank for a while there. I wasn't surprised when Joe decided, you know, I'm not a Nazi. I think he was being a patriot. And when he saw what the world really was and what could be with the film.
Yeah.
I think that was maybe, if anything was predictable, that was.
You knew that he's such a likable guy. You knew that he was going to turn and join the fight, as it were, I guess you could say.
Now, I'm surprised.
Hey there, guys and gals.
It surprised me, and we talked about the oldest boy. We hinted at that. And, of course, since we've already given away spoilers, let's just give it away. The boy is diagnosed with a congenital disease.
Yeah.
That is going to be a big crisis, I believe, in the second season. I'll predict that.
Yeah.
He had not John Smith had not yet told his wife.
Yeah.
And interesting scene where she's coming into bed and she's talking about a family member who had some congenital disease. And thank goodness they no longer make those poor people suffer. And she doesn't know that her son had just been diagnosed.
Yeah.
And we know where that's going to have to go. So now, are the Smiths going to use the hypodermic needle that the doctor gave? Or might John Smith suddenly be a hypocrite and send the boy off to
Canada
or wherever. Mexico, which we find out is a safe haven for refugees, or maybe to the neutral zone
exactly.
Colorado.
Exactly, because the thing is, because one of the things that we sort of like, we also discovered, I mean, we are glossing over so much, because the thing is that there's there was an assassination attempt on the crown prince from Japan. There's the entire, and I think this is a very important subplot, which is, it's very easy, the tensions between the Japanese and the Germans.
Oh,
and
yes.
The talk of an upcoming Third World War, whereas a Third World War, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Whether you want to admit it or not, the Third World War is going to happen within Man in the High Castle, and what happens?
Well, that gets back to the final scene in the closing episode of the season. Perfect segue. Perfect segue, guys. We've been into this for not quite an hour, I think. But I think that's the perfect segue. What is the Japanese? Played by the fantastic. The character Nobusuke Tagomi?
Yes.
The trade minister?
Yes. Tagomi. Yes.
He has first this vision of the destruction of San Francisco. He's sitting there out in the park. He hears all the sound, and suddenly he opens his eyes, and it's our San Francisco.
Yes. There's a lot
And he gets this big grin on his face. Because now it has all this life and the chaos of America taking place around him.
So, I mean, once again, there's another character keeping it meta. Whereas there's another character who knows, dude, this is not our reality. This is not reality. Something happened. And it was just like, you have all these like little bits, whereas, and it's like, and it gets back to the Man in the High Castle, the title character, whom I don't know if we've actually seen him or not. And it raises a lot of questions. Where is the Man in the High Castle getting the movies? Where is he getting this film? Why is it that he releases it out into the public, the underground, and then he collects his movies back after they've been in circulation for a while? Go ahead.
I was about to ask you. Maybe I misunderstood. I didn't think he was releasing them to the public. I thought he was simply trying to collect them in the same way that both the Germans and the Japanese, because Hitler had a whole library.
Yeah. So the question is, if it's not the Man in the High Castle, who's releasing these movies? Because I know, quote unquote, that it's the Man in the High Castle who is releasing these movies out into the public, because I've read the original book.
Oh, I have too, but they've broken so much.
There's so much. There's a little confusion. There's a little confusion about the origin of the movies themselves.
And wasn't, if I recall, it was a book in the novel.
Yeah.
Not newsreels.
Yeah. So you just go through these, and there's all these mysteries that we're being introduced to and we're being exposed to. And the question is, where are we going with this? Because the thing is that the makers of this TV show have already broken away from the original story by Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we go from there? And the question is that we were left with a cliffhanger, because Joe Blake was caught sneaking around Obengubenfuhrer John Smith's office, his home office. And when he found a file folder marked Man in the High Castle, The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, he goes in and he breaks into his office and he finds that there's blank pages, and the lights come up and there's Obengubenfuhrer standing there. And that's the cliffhanger. And we know.
Wait a minute, was it?
Yeah.
I thought Joe Blake ends up going off to Mexico on the boat.
Trying to remember who goes off on the boat. No, I thought that was Frank Joe. I thought that was Frank that. Well, I mean,
no. Joe ends up being the resistance wants this guy. Germans want this guy. The Japanese, of course, when they learn that the Germans want him, they want him too. And Juliana helps him get a boat, a fishing boat, and they come running up, and he's on the fishing boat, and Joe's going up. I know the scene you're talking about,
yeah,
but it's not the cliffhanger. That was the trade minister waking up and opening his eyes in the beautiful chaos of the real world San Francisco.
There are so many episodes, mm-hmm. whereas then each episode has its own sort of little cliffhanger. So,
oh yeah, that's a good point.
So the question is, what is going to happen in season two?
Oh, that's a good one. I'm glad to say that I can't predict that.
Because usually I'm pretty good at this. I can pretty much predict what. Not just so much what should happen, but what is going to happen. And I definitely believe that if there are going to be subsequent seasons after season two, I can pretty much guarantee there is going to be an all-out war between Germany and Japan in future seasons, because it's just inevitable. I think it's inevitable. But I think that it was just like, it's going to be interesting to see where the direction of the show goes in light of the political environment here in the United States now. Mm-hmm. See what happens.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if they do make commentaries about the current, not just here in the United States, but other Western countries,
yeah,
around the world. It's going to be interesting to see if they start inserting at least maybe subtle commentaries that people go, oh, we know what you're talking about, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
I think that what's also going to be interesting, and I think that they're going to have to address another issue that I think is important. I think that they're going to have to address, like, what else is going on elsewhere? Have the Nazis been to the moon yet? What's going on in Africa? You'll see that, you'll notice that there are not a lot of black people in Man in the High Castle, with the exception of some blacks being seen in the neutral zone. And you don't see a lot of Jews, and if you see any Asians, you see them on the western half of the United States. It's going to be interesting to see what happened to all these people.
Yeah.
And how do we deal with this?
It's going to be interesting, and I bet it's going to be probably pretty, knowing the way they've handled this matter, probably pretty horrifying. I think they're going to start, pulling back from the Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah.
View of the Nazis and kind of start getting a little grittier and a little more disturbing answers to the questions that you gave. I mean, I do, you know, speaking of technology, you're talking about going to the moon, the rocket plane, as is mentioned in the novel and they use in the TV show, is a Concorde.
Exactly.
Up a few years. I don't think it had made it by 61. I think it was like 1970 or so when it flew. But that only makes sense. They, you know, it's a little bit more advanced. And then they refer to the atomic bomb as the Heisenberg machine or something, the Heisenberg device.
We need to find out what the Heisenberg device is.
Everything I've read is the atomic bomb.
Well, I think we're going to have to find out here. And by the way, I'm going to read this off to you, and I think this is the perfect place to leave the show because we've gone over time. I'm going to read the synopsis. I just found this on Amazon.
Cool.
And it says, and we have until December 16th, which is going to be a little later for me because, I mean, obviously, hey, December 16th, Rogue One. After giving Joe the film, Juliana is forced to flee the fury of the resistance while embarking on a new path to save her home from destruction. Joe confronts his absent father in Berlin, who is not who he seems. Smith wrestles with what to do about his ill son. Frank takes a gamble with his life and is a bid to save Ed. I'm sure we remember Ed from the original, his little Weasley buddy.
And
Tagomi's life is turned upside down by his quote-unquote travel to an alternate world. So that is, it is probably, and I'm going to say this, I cannot say this enough, if you're a Diesel Punker and you have not seen Man in the High Castle, it is worth the nut to pay to Amazon to see this on Amazon Prime. I'm telling you, it's worth it. It's also worth it for the free shipping, and I'm not getting paid to say this.
I agree completely. I mean, I took it originally to see this.
Yeah.
And I'm hooked on Amazon Prime. And now I'm getting a bit hooked on Amazon Prime now. But that's another subject. This is fantastic, guys.
My suggestion to everybody, go see Rogue One. Give yourself some time to digest Rogue One. Then when you're ready, after you've seen Rogue One at least once, sit down and watch Man in the High Castle. Do yourself, don't make the same mistake I made. Don't binge watch it two nights in a row. Take one episode a day or two episodes a day. And you're going to be so tempted. You're going to say, I got to know what's next. It streams together and things happen so quickly. You got to give yourself time to digest it or watch it all at once and then go back and watch one episode a day and come back and then tell us, seek us out on Facebook and say, oh, dude, that was the best or whatever. Because, I mean, I guarantee you it is literally the best thing on television. And it was just like this. It's like, I'm telling you, it's better than Orange is the New Black. It's better than Stranger Things. And I love Stranger Things. But it is by far one of the most captivating, intriguing, and thought-provoking and frustrating TV shows I've ever seen in my life. So how about you, Larry? What's your final word on Man in the High Castle?
Wow, it's hard to beat what you just said, because you really captured it. It is pure Diesel Punk goodness. It really captures the spirit of the genre. The acting is extraordinary. Even if one is not into science fiction, though who's not, but if one is not into science fiction fantasy, the characters are so well written, they're so well acted, it's Ridley Scott at his best. Again, I think Eric made a good point. Frankly, I like the idea. Watch two episodes at a time. There's only 10 episodes. Now, I was thinking before I went back and watched it again that, oh, wait a minute, there was like about 15, 20. No, there's 10 episodes. But there's so much good stuff in every episode. They take so much care to make it quality that you just and you're wanting more every time. It is good stuff. It's worth the cost of Amazon Prime alone. And then you throw in all the wonderful perks of Amazon Prime, the next day shipping and now Amazon Prime Now and stuff like that. So, you know, Amazon's got himself a winner. I can't recommend it enough. So, Eric, we need to be wrapping this up. Season 2 starts December 16th. We're going to be recording shortly after that. And we're going to do this regularly, folks. We're going to talk about every week the previous episode. We're going to be loaded with spoilers and commentary and opinion. And we're going to do these microcasts back to back on a regular basis. Right, Eric?
Oh, are you crazy? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that what we should do is we should probably do keep it short and give just like, let's just talk about 10 minutes about what happened. What I'd like to be able to do is you watch an episode and then you come back to the diesel powered podcast, listen to what we had to say, and then go back and watch the next episode and then come back and listen to what we have to say. And it was just like, we're going to be right. I'm telling you right now, we are going to be sitting here right here with you. And it's going to be like, imagine two of your best friends sitting with you watching the show. But I'm better than your best friend because I keep quiet the entire time. I'm not one of those people who I hate people who talk in the middle of the show.
Oh, yes. Especially this one.
Do yourself a favor and get back to us. So anyway, Larry, what a phenomenal evening. What a great evening. So
this has been fun. This has been fun. All right, my friend. You want to last few words before I close this out?
The only thing I can tell you is that all I can tell you guys is just to keep your chins up and your fedoras on and keep listening, because 2017 is right around the corner and we got a ton of really fun stuff coming down the pike. Not just Man in the High Castle. We got a ton of other stuff too. And also, look out for our special on Rogue One. We're going to be talking about Rogue One in the not too distant future. So,
fantastic. All right, folks. Well, this wraps up this first microcast on the Man in the High Castle. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and look forward to talking to you next time. In the meantime, take good care of each other, because that's what life is all about. Take it easy. Bye, y'all.